Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Guest host Amanda Maxim. I'm here in the studio. Yaron is out. He is out. Well, we should have a map, some sort of an app online where you can say, where in the world is Yaron Brook? I'm told that Yaron is now in South America. He's doing a tour for the launch of his new book, Equal is Unfair. So I'm here to get another punch on my guest host ticket. And I'm excited because today we're going to talk about selfishness, Earth Day, and babies. And I'm here with philosopher Aaron Smith. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. What do you do?
Well, I'm an instructor at the Ayn Rand Institute. I teach in the Objectivist Academic Center. It's our educational program. Teach in the summer internship. And also write and speak on behalf of the Institute.
Great. I hope everyone can hear me. I have to sit a little bit further away from the microphone to accommodate. I can't really pull up too close to the table here because I have to accommodate my giant belly. And why is my belly so huge right now? Well, I am 9 months pregnant, so I'm about to have a baby. And so that's one of the reasons I want to talk about babies today and how that ties into selfishness and Earth Day. I want to start with this news story that I saw recently. It's about a woman named Holly Brockwell, and she's a technology journalist in the UK. And she's been outspoken about her desire to get sterilized. In other words, she wants to permanently preclude the possibility of ever having children. She's made this decision when she's quite young, in her 20s, and she's been having a hard time convincing a doctor to perform the operation for her. Now, in terms of what are her reasons, why is she doing this? Is it rational or irrational for her to have made this decision? That's not something that I particularly want to comment on, but I think what's interesting about the story is something that she's been told over and over again when she tells people, I've made the decision that I don't want to have children. And that is that she's been accused of being selfish. So she said that doctors have called her selfish, and that's one of the most common responses that she gets when she talks to people on the street or people on Twitter that chime in response to her saying she's sure that she doesn't want to have children. And so that's why I'm excited to have Aaron Smith here, because I'm interested in this point of view. So tell me, Aaron, break it down for me. Why would people call someone they've made a decision that, look, having children, it's not for me. It's not something that I want to spend my life doing. Why would they call someone like that selfish?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons, Amanda, but I think the two most prominent, maybe two and a half, are one, you have some sort of obligation to God, which supersedes your own choices and your happiness. So by choosing not to have kids, for example, you're placing your own life and happiness above God's plan. And the idea is you're supposed to conform to God's will if the idea is that, God intended us to have children, to come together, have families, make babies, and so on, that by placing your own choices, your own life, your own happiness ahead of that, that there's something wrong and something selfish and inappropriate about that. And I think the other one, which is probably more common today, is that you have an obligation to society, which supersedes your own happiness. So you should do your part and contribute to society. So by having children, you can have a positive impact on the world and so on. Or looked at the same point from a different perspective. By having children, you're contributing, and in effect, another taxpayer who's going to then, you know, earn a living and so on and contribute to the general welfare state kind of situation. And so in both cases, you know, you either have an obligation to God or you have an obligation to society. I mean, I had a professor who I like and respect who made this point to me in office hours once. He said, look, you and your wife, you guys are really nice people, good people, moral people, and educated and so on. It's like, if you guys should have children. I mean, you know, you could bring in some, you know, very well-raised people into the world, and we need more. And I mean, he didn't try to guilt me into anything, but it was just, there is that real perspective out there. And in both cases, the idea is the mother has a moral obligation to reproduce for others. And that's something, you know, the Rand rejects.
So tell me a little bit more about what you think about that. So you made the decision not to have children. Is that right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
And so do you consider that a selfish choice? Did God come into it at all? What about this idea that, you know, your obligation to society? Does that part of your decision?
Okay. Lots of questions there. So one, does God come into it? No, I'm an atheist. I did make the decision not to have children. I mean, I love kids. I used to coach gymnastics for about, geez, like 13 years, preschool through high school. I love kids. They're fantastic. And then I get to send them home at the end of the day. But I really like them. But it's an enormous decision to figure out whether you want to raise another human being from helplessness to adulthood. And it's an enormous commitment. And it's not something I'm interested in doing. I don't think about decisions like that in terms of contribution to society. I don't even think about my work as a philosopher, as a contribution to society. I think about it as, what do I want to do with the time I have on Earth, which is short. And I figure out, how can I make the most of that and just wring the most out of life?
So if you decide not to have children, is it a selfish decision to say that?
It perfectly well can be, but I think selfish in a proper sense. I mean, you're making a decision which you take to be something that's going to enhance your life so that you can get the most out of it. In that sense, in Ayn Rand's sense of selfish, it can be perfectly rationally selfish.
This is another phenomenon that I've seen that may be at play here, that sometimes when you see somebody making a decision for themselves or the betterment of or for their life, so say that this woman decides, I don't want to have children, and other people maybe who've had children or have felt obligated to have children look at that as kind of a personal affront to themselves. Can you explain what's happening with that kind of point of view?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly another thing that factors in here. When you call somebody selfish, when you're treating that as a term of abuse, like it's a criticism. It is true that there are some people who, whether through conformity or passivity, simply accept that, you know, what a woman's supposed to do, you know, you're supposed to have a baby, do like what everyone else does. And then when they see somebody else opt out and they put their own happiness first, and they're going on vacations and they're going out restauranting and they're gallivanting around, as you could put it, and they think, well, I wish I had that freedom. And they know that at some point I had the choice to make that call, and I get to do it or not to do it. And I chose to do it, and now I regret it. Or at least I look on people with a certain resentment about it. And I think there is that phenomenon. I mean, lots of parents, I should hasten to say, don't have that attitude at all. They just, like, I mean, a bunch of my coworkers have kids. Nobody looks at me askance in the office, but there is that phenomenon. It does happen.
Is that, so that attitude towards people when they do they're doing their own thing, they're putting themselves first and making decisions based on what's going to make their life happy and their life better, versus I'm going to do what God tells me to do, or what, you know, convention the conventional view is, you know, you should have children because it's I don't know, just what you do, or your mother wants you to have to give her grandchildren or something like that. Can you tell me, is that something that Ayn Rand writes about? Like, it kind of occurs to me that maybe, is that something that, like, Howard Roark in The Fountainhead, does he experience that kind of attitude as well?
So this whole phenomena of what Ayn Rand would call being kind of first-handed versus being second-handed, you know, about living your life by placing others in terms of by placing others as your first priority, whether in terms of your thinking and your valuing. In other words, other people's opinions matter more than my own. I should put that first. Other people's values should be the one that populate my own set of values. And what other people want should be the main kind of guidepost, which I determine how I should live my life, how I should make my choices. And she dramatizes that in the character, among others, of Peter Keating. And Roark is a man of independence, of integrity. He lives his own way. He doesn't place other people as any kind of a primary consideration in terms of what he's doing. He has a certain kind of work, which is architecture, and he wants to do his work his own way, because that's a form of his personal happiness. That doesn't place him outside the bounds of society or friendliness or whichever, but he places that first. And she does dramatize this in various points in the novel, that Roark does seem to spark a certain kind of resentment in other people. And she describes it, you know, kind of as, you know, third person sort of narrator, as the novelist, as they experienced a certain kind of resentment and they didn't know why. It was something that he sparked in them, and some of that, depending on the character that we're talking about, some of that really comes from the fact that someone like that stands as a certain kind of assessment or reproach, you know, by reflection on the way they live their lives. There's some of that going on, but we'd have to
open
sure up the book.
Well, I think we should maybe take a step back. So it sounds like you're saying that selfishness is a good thing, and that's kind of been, you know, inherent in what we've been discussing. And I want to take a step back and talk about selfishness in general, and also come back to my decision to have children and why I think that it's a selfish decision, but in a good way. So one of the most common questions that we get at ARI is, why call it selfishness? Why use that term? I mean, Ayn Rand has a book titled The Virtue of Selfishness. It's very provocative as a title, and it, mainly because it seems like everybody knows that selfishness is a bad thing. So why use the word selfishness? Why call it that?
Because she's picking a fight. She's picking an intellectual fight. What she says is the conventional notion of selfishness is what she calls a package deal. In other words, it puts two or more things that don't belong together and tries to treat them as one package, as one unit. So, for example, the conventional view of selfishness puts together into one package things like concern for one's own interest, right? And things like preying on others, callous disregard for others, indifference to other people, and so on. And it treats that as a unit. So when you call somebody selfish, they're going after their own self-interest. They don't care about other people. They trample other people to get whatever they feel they want. And what that does is that association smears any kind of – it doesn't elevate – put it this way. Let me step back. It doesn't elevate predation and disregard for others. What it does is it smears self-interest. It smears concern for one's own interest by suggesting that it involves those latter elements. And Rand thinks it's just totally wrong to bundle those two things together. But that's a philosophical fight to pick. And it's one she wants to have because she thinks that what your self-interest involves is preying on other people and disregarding, like having complete lack of concern for other people, that's not actually in your interest. And it's wrong to associate those two together. But now that's what she elaborates in that book that you referred to, The Virtue of Selfishness, in some detail and from many angles. Yeah.
So, all right. So most people, when they think of a selfish person, you know, the kind of person that comes to mind is, you know, the guy who, cuts you off in traffic, flips you the bird, just, you know, someone who just is not a nice person, basically a jerk. And
that never happens out here on the 405.
Never experienced that. What kind of a person would you or would Ayn Rand, you know, epitomize or think is actually a selfish person, or who epitomizes selfishness if it's not that guy?
Okay, well let me preface that by saying, what do people usually call selfish? And then we'll say something about what Ayn Rand would consider a selfish person. When somebody says Jones is selfish, since selfishness is a package deal, it's not always clear what part of the package they're referring to or criticizing. In some cases, what they're criticizing is the fact that the guy pursues his own interests. He puts his own interests first and he lives his own life. He doesn't subordinate his concerns to, you know, service to the community or whichever. And many people think that's bad. Rand disagrees. In other cases, what's being criticized is the person's utter disregard for other people, like the so-called selfish jerk, right? The kind of person who steps on other people, shoves them out of the way to get what he wants in whatever form. And that, of course, is a problem. But the association of that with self-interest is what Rand is trying to challenge. And so when Rand characterizes the selfish individual from her view of what selfishness is, if you want to know what that's like, the short answer is, well, take a look at her novels and take a look at the heroes and heroines in her novels. And it provides a much richer, deeper, illuminating sort of picture than a kind of abstract sketch I can give. But what I would say in essence is the selfish person from Rand's perspective is the person who lives a life dedicated to pursuing and enjoying the values that actually objectively support and enhance his life and over the course of his whole life. And that involves a fairly rich life of production, in other words, producing and earning the kind of values your life requires, love, self-esteem, and it requires living a life of reason. In other words, where you make your choices and you choose your values according to a rational standard in terms of what action, because how else are you going to figure out? I mean, this is not self-evident. So if you ask somebody, which values should I pursue? Which values are the ones that objectively enhance and support my life over the long term? Which values are those? And what kinds of virtues should I adhere to in my life? Should I live by the seat of my pants or should I follow certain kind of principles? I mean, that's a whole work of moral philosophy is to figure that out. So when Rand says you should be selfish, she's not giving her blessing to do as you please, follow any whim. How did I hear that put once? Don't worry. There's a common expression for that, which expresses that. And it's not just follow your whim. It's demanding. And it requires a lot of serious thinking and dedication to principles over time.
Well, that's interesting. So, because I think the common view would be like being selfish should be the easiest thing that you could possibly do. You do whatever you feel like doing at the moment. And you're saying, no,
yeah, so
it requires
selfishness,
work.
So selfishness is not equivalent to desire satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're right. I mean, people say, well, selfishness is easy. Morality is really hard. And she said, no, selfishness is a full-time job, and it's not easy, precisely for the reasons I gave, is that it's not easy to figure out exactly what are those values you should pursue and how to pursue them across time in the face of pressure to compromise and so on. But she doesn't think that being selfish is a matter of desire satisfaction. You have a set of desires, which are your desires, and then you go satisfy them. So if it's just the fact that it's your desire doesn't make it selfish, it doesn't make, put it this way, it doesn't make it objectively in your self-interest to pursue that desire. That depends on the relationship between that desire and what your life requires and what your goals are and your priorities and so on. So if you have a desire, a whole set of desires, of things you want out of life, things that you want to do, that's not enough for that to count as self-interested, not rationally self-interested in terms of the way in the way Rand thinks about it. You have to establish the relationship of that desire to your nature as a human being, toward the requirements of your life, toward what makes your life go well over the long term. And that requires thinking.
So maybe we should quick relate that back to the decision to have or not have have children. So if you really want to be selfish about that decision, what kinds of things are you going to be looking at?
Oof. Well, that's tricky, I would say. So I'm not a parent. But when I think about that, I think, well, this involves a significant emotional commitment, financial commitment, time commitment over decades. And you have to figure out, is that something I want? But then on the other hand, you have to think about, because maybe you just don't like kids. Maybe you just you can't stand there screaming and you whatever, and you don't want to be around them. And that's your business. That's fine. If that's not something you want to have as an aspect of your life, so be it. But you also have to think about, you know, how much joy this could bring to you. What kinds of things that this could bring as a new element to your life, which before you didn't have and now you want. I remember listening to I'm going to wind up misquoting this, and that's fine. But I remember in a Q&A, Leonard Peikoff was asked something about having a baby, and he said something like, I had no idea. He's like, I thought, I'm a philosopher, right? I can abstract. I can imagine, you know, what that would be like and so on. But he said, I had no idea, because then he had children, that how much work it is on the one hand, even no matter what, how much I read about it. But then he says, I never also could project how much joy I got out of it. Because they tell you, you know, it's be great and so on, and it's a lot of work, but it's really rewarding. And I don't know that there's actually a way in which you can actually project that in any real terms, because it's not really emotionally meaningful, I think, to you when you're not in that context. But you have to project that, and you have to think, is that, because there's a risk involved, you know, as well. And you have to think about whether the risk is worth a potential reward. Is that an aspect that you want to add to your life? And that's a very personal choice.
Yeah. So for my part, I'll say that having children, I view it as a selfish endeavor. That's something that I wanted to do, something that has added to my life. And I really think, you know, when I look at my the daughter that I have, and then I have another one here on the way, but it's intensely pleasurable. Like, I love to watch her discover new things, to see the world through her eyes, to teach her to become, to grow up and how to do things, and watching her go from not knowing how to do anything and to being able to, you know, do something as simple as roll over or grab a toy or say her first word, that those things are just, you know, significant values, you know, value to me. And yeah, so I view the decision as a selfish decision, and that something that I wanted to do, and that I'm getting, you know, intense joy and pleasure from doing.
And I mean, I can totally understand that. I mean, I've been over to your place and I've met your daughter, and frankly, it is really joyful. And I just turn into a grinning idiot when I go over there. And frankly, my cheeks hurt when I left, you know, just cause she's adorable, and just the way she looks up and I don't know, I don't want to get all zappy, but it was, I can get it. I'll put it that way. I mean, I can get the sheer joy that comes out of that. And that is an enhancement in your life.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, talk about what are some of your concerns though? I mean, do you have some concerns or am I just a chicken?
Well, no, I mean, it's a lot of, it's a lot of work, and you know, all the things that people say are true, that you might not sleep as much, financially. It's, you know, how am I going to pay for the things that I want her to have? But all those things, while they're true, they're in some ways not important, if that makes sense, that she is just such an incredible value, that the rest of it, you know, we'll work it out. It's, you know, you talk about a hierarchy of values. I'm not sure if that's what that means, but it seems to me that that's exactly what that means, that things are that are important to you, that increase your happiness, those should be put first, and the rest of it, you know, it somehow just doesn't It doesn't matter.
So let me ask you this, and I'll sort of turn the question on you then. People often think of self-interest or selfishness as you devote, how would I put this, that you don't care about the well-being of someone else, of other people. And yet, as a mother, of course, you spend a lot of your time being concerned specifically about the welfare of your child. So how does that fit into selfishness? I mean, where does that, how does that fit in? I mean, obviously some of the stuff you said was already relevant, but.
Well, because she's my child. So it's my, it's something, because she's my child. So I don't view it as, you know, as a sacrifice. I think that's, we can talk more about sacrifice later, but I think it's a distortion of the word sacrifice when people say having children and taking care of them is a sacrifice, because it is, it's my, my chosen path in life and my chosen value. And it's, I think it would be an abomination to view it as anything or as a sacrifice or as something that, where I'm giving something up, because watching her grow up and being a part of that is part of my happiness. Yes, it does involve me taking care of her and doing all the things that, you know, that involves, from the nitty gritty of it all to the, the fun stuff too. But it's all part of what it means to raise a child. And it's part of what it means to increase my happiness.
So you're saying there's not a conflict then, between the pursuit of your self-interest and your care, often extreme care, for the well-being of other people.
That's right.
Yeah, so when they're your value, they fit somewhere into your hierarchy of values. And so it's like pursuing your own values. That's one of the things on the road to that is focusing on the well-being of your child.
That's right. All right, well, let's take a quick commercial break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
The critics of income inequality say they are for social justice. But what does that mean? It means that if you are really productive, if you work hard, create a lot of wealth, and make a lot of money, you're doing something bad. You're creating inequality. So what's fair? Well, some say what's fair is to have the government take a bunch of your money and give it to other people. Why do these people deserve to be given money from others? The answer is because they didn't create much wealth. That's what it all comes down to. Social justice says we should punish people who have done nothing wrong for the sake of people who have not been wronged. On the other hand, justice says we should only punish people for the wrong they've done to others. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
All right. So I want to talk with you, Aaron, a little bit more about philosophical topics like selfishness and altruism and benevolence. So I've noticed that, you know, you're quite a nice guy. You know, you told me that you're talking before about, you know, living a selfish life and how that's a good thing. But at the same time, I've seen you hold doors for people, help them get things off of a high shelf. Can you tell me, how do acts like that fit into leading a selfish life?
Well, I think things like that I regard those as a matter of general benevolence. And I think that grows out of a feeling of respect for other people, a general sense of respect for other people, and a sense of camaraderie as human beings. Holding the door for people and all these kinds of things, this is not, you know, a moral requirement, and nor should it be a sacrifice. I think what it really amounts to is it's a kind of response we have to people when we look on them as potential values. I at least don't typically do things like that out of a calculation to get some sort of return. You know, if I hold the door, maybe they'll hold the door for me on the way out. And I just don't think about it in those terms. I think most people don't. But, you know, I would say that there is typically some kind of a return, even if it's just a smile or the feeling of living in a human world. Sometimes it's just enjoying one's own efficacy. I'm not tall, but I'm tall enough. And so, you know, walking through an aisle at a grocery store, for example, and I see some, you know, short woman trying to reach a cereal box on a high shelf or something like that. And, you know, I walk past and, you know, kind of hand it down to her or something like that. It's just an enjoyment of one's own efficacy. I mean, you don't walk around the grocery store trying to, like, do things for people. I mean, you know, I'm not Peter Keating in that respect.
I didn't remember that part of the Fountainhead.
That was a deleted scene.
Oh, he goes through the grocery store.
In the director's cut.
He helps people, pushes their carts and stuff.
No, I mean, it's actually not what Peter Keating would do at all, unless he was angling for a job. But that's the funny thing, is that there's a general sort of benevolence, which is authentic, which grows out of a sense of, look, these are human beings, and I have a general sort of respect and a camaraderie for them because of what kinds of values that they can bring and that they're capable of, kind of virtue. And I think you look on them in a different way, in a quite natural way. So it's a difference between a sort of forced benevolence, if you want to call it that, where you're supposed to do, you know, 10 nice things for people a day, and it's as a, some sort of like standing rule. That's just not the way I think it grows. Not when it's authentic. It's not the way you think about it. But if you look at it from the other perspective, if you look on other people as, you know, the people to whom you owe sacrifice, I think it's something one does with gritted teeth and resentment, not with benevolence and goodwill and a genuine feeling of, like, you know, fellow feeling and so on. And there's more. It's funny because it's like you don't do this for some calculated effect. I think it's typically the way it happens. But there's often a lot of unexpected returns that just comes out. And why? Because people are not all swine, right? I mean, people actually do have values to offer. And, you know, we wind up getting in conversations with people at restaurants and so on. And you wind up in a lot of interesting conversations and you find that, look, there's a lot of value to just be had out of other people just by being human, you know, with them. And I think that's I enjoy living in that kind of atmosphere. And it's not like I'm trying to create a change in the world that I want to see. I don't think that makes sense. I don't imagine that if I hold the door for somebody or somebody drops their wallet and I pick it up, that I'm somehow making a small change in the world. And then they're going to say, gee whiz, you know, maybe somebody drops their wallet, I should do it. I don't think that happens. Maybe it does, but that's certainly not any part of the motivation. It's just like, I'm a human being, and that's how people should respond to each other. Well, unless they prove, you know, that they don't deserve it. But yeah.
So it seems like if there's confusion about what selfishness is, then isn't there also, is there confusion also about what altruism is? Because I hear you saying, look, benevolence is, it's part of, you know, it's part of a healthy attitude towards humanity, and that's just kind of what you do. You're saying you're not getting necessarily moral credit for doing these things, but it's just, it's part of, you know, being a happy person. But I also know that Ayn Rand was, you called altruism evil, outright
yep.
evil. So how does that work? Because isn't benevolence or altruism just, you know, holding the door, helping the old lady across the street? Isn't that what altruism is?
No, it isn't. But that's how it gets its traction, I think, in the culture. Or that's one of the reasons why it gets its traction. So altruism is, in essence, the idea that no individual has the moral right to live for his own sake, that service to others is a moral duty, and it's his central virtue. So let's be clear about what that is. I mean, a sacrifice. And Ayn Rand's definition of this is astute. A sacrifice means giving up something more important to you for something that's less important to you or unimportant. As she put it, it's a sacrifice of a greater value for a lesser or a non-value. So to put it in just normal terms, it means net personal loss. So the primary virtue is net personal loss. And so that's what she takes altruism to be. But people package that together with things like benevolence, the kind of benevolence I was talking about, or respect for the rights of others. And again, Ayn Rand thinks you need to separate those. And just like selfishness, the conventional view of selfishness, she thinks that the conventional view of altruism is a package deal. It lumps together things like self-sacrifice, giving up values for things you value less, with being nice to people, respecting the rights of others. And there's no logical connection between those at all. She's an advocate of selfishness and of benevolence and of respecting the rights of others. She thinks those actually belong together, that it's actually in your self-interest to respect the rights of others and so on. And she thinks that benevolence is a natural outgrowth of a rationally self-interested life. So she thinks you should be grouping those with selfishness, with rational selfishness, and not with altruism. And why does she think altruism is evil? If you take altruism to mean, I'll put it this way, because life requires achieving and enjoying values, not losing them, not giving them up. And if you preach giving up as the central virtue, then you really harm, you know, human life by that means.
So it sounds like you've done a lot of work trying to sort out, you know, what does selfishness mean? What is altruism? What is sacrifice? Why take the time to do that? Why is it important to get those concepts right?
Well, in general, you have to know what's good and what's bad. And you have to know how to live your life morally and how to evaluate the people and the actions around you. And if you think of selfishness in the same breath as indifference to others, it's not going to be very appealing. And you're going to associate self-interest with that. Whereas what you should be doing is pursuing your own self-interest, achieving values and enjoying them. And similarly with altruism, how do you evaluate people that you there is no category, put it this way, doing things for other people. So how do you evaluate that? Is it good to do things for other people? What does that mean, do things for other people? Does it mean like you do things for your daughter because you love your daughter and you want her to succeed and that's part of your happiness? Or does it mean giving up a career to make your mother happy, or giving up 50% of your income to contribute to humanity or something? There's no way to evaluate those in a vacuum. So doing things for others doesn't mean anything. I would say it depends on the context. What are you doing? What is your motivation? What is the relationship between your action and the requirements of your life and happiness? And I think that you have to actually sort that out. I mean, if you ask just introspectively, look, I'm an advocate of selfishness, but I do these nice things for people. What's up with that? I mean, is that an outgrowth of my self-interest? Is it related? Is it just, I don't know, not even a philosophical issue at all? Maybe it's just my personality. And you have to just intellectually just sort that out and find out what is the relationship between things like benevolence and self-interest? And what is the relationship between benevolence and sacrifice, if any? And sorting those out is actually illuminating.
Yeah, so I guess I have one more question about sacrifice, because we didn't really talk about that concept too much. But I hear people using sacrifice in a way that it strikes me as wrong, or it rubs me at least the wrong way. Like someone who says, I'm sacrificing now to, I'm using money to go to college, and that's a sacrifice because I don't get to go to the movies as often or go out for a nice dinner because I'm trying to put money into an education. Or the same thing I've heard about children as well, that having children is a sacrifice. What's going on? Are they using the concept of sacrifice correctly there?
They might be, but that depends on what the situation is. The thing is, you have to distinguish between a sacrifice and an investment. So in an investment, you forego certain things in the short term for the sake of a greater value. It's a trade up, whereas a sacrifice is a trade down. So if you trade a dollar bill for a $10 bill, that's a trade up. If you give up a dollar bill now in the hopes of getting a $10 bill next week, that's a trade up, assuming you don't need it immediately. If you trade a $10 bill for a dollar bill, that's a trade down. And it works in the same way with your life choices. I paid a lot of money for my college, and I'm still paying for that. But that I regard as an investment. It's something the kind of education that I went through is required for the field that I do and required for the kind of pursuit that makes my life enjoyable and worthwhile and fulfilling. And that's something I'm willing to go through. Yeah, I have a monthly payment and so on loans and things like that. But that's an investment. It's a trade up. Whereas a sacrifice is really a trade down. And trading down is not a principle to live your life by, if you want to be happy.
Yeah, so I think if someone were to tell me, you are having children, Amanda, is a sacrifice for you, I would say that that's just the wrong use of that word, and it's actually kind of a disgusting way to look at, having children, because it's not a sacrifice. I'm not trading something that's of higher value for something that's of no value or lower value.
Yeah, and you don't want to hear from your parent, I've sacrificed so much for you. Parents say that, and sometimes they just mean exactly what you mean, that they've foregone a number of things they could have done for that. But if they mean that, it's like, look, I've given up a lot, for your benefit, and it was a sacrifice on my part. Yeah, you don't want to hear that. I mean, sacrifice breeds resentment. Everybody can introspect that, I think. Everything from, you really wanted to do something and your friend convinced you to do something else. And it wasn't just a mutual adjudication of claims like, okay, so fine, we'll go see the Truffaut film today and we'll go see the Ozu film tomorrow. I wanted to see that tonight, but okay, fine. That's not a sacrifice. But when you really do sacrifice, you know it, and you experience resentment, frustration, and so on.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. Seven great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
All right, so we're back, and I want to talk now, turn topics to, I still want to talk about babies, got babies on the brain. But I also want to talk about Earth Day and how that Earth Day and environmentalism, how that relates to children.
Yeah, so if we're switching gears to talk about environmentalism and babies and so on, let me ask you something, because I found something that's all over the news. Well, it's all over the news. It's on the web and so on. People saying that having children in this day and age is actually selfish. For environmental reasons. In other words, if you're going to have a child, the amount of fossil fuels that the child's going to require to burn, you know, throughout its life, its carbon footprint, as they put the term, you're really increasing your carbon footprint by having a child. And you might think, well, if I recycle and I bring a bag to Whole Foods and I ride my bike to work and stuff, it'll offset that. And they're saying, well, the idea is, well, no, it's not. That's insignificant compared to what having a child is like. And that, so for environmental reasons, you should not have a child. And if you choose to have one, it's selfish. I mean, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, and let me take that one step further, because I've also seen this, and I think it's a really disturbing trend. In some ways, it's not surprising that that's where the environmentalist movement has gone, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But, like, for example, in the British Medical Journal, there was an article by a doctor and a professor of family planning, and they say that, you know, having a couple who plans to have more than two children, so having a third child, they need to really consider not doing that. And why? Well, it's because they say, quote, having one last child than intended is the simplest and biggest contribution anyone can make to leaving the planet habitable for our grandchildren. And, unquote. And furthermore, they say that having a third child is, or not having a third child is, quote, analogous to avoiding patio heaters and high carbon cars, unquote. So I think what they're doing here is, I don't know, when I look at my child, I don't think of oh, there, I could have had a patio heater, or I could have had had the baby. So let me expand on it a little bit more, that because I see a lot of bloggers making bloggers and environmentalists, people who are, you know, consider themselves green, making a decision to not have children because it's good, quote, you know, for the planet. So I think this whole way of thinking about children is wrong. And why is it wrong? I think it's because what environmentalism is telling us to do is wrong. So everything that we do to sustain our lives has an impact on nature. So whether that's, you know, driving to the store or using, you know, fossil fuels to make our lives better, going to the hospital, everything that we do to make our lives better involves some sort of an impact on nature. And that's in fact what makes being a human being great. That's what makes our lives good. Every value that we create advancing our well-being is going to have some sort of impact on nature. And so I think the standard of value, how we make decisions in our lives, needs to be human-centered. And I see this as a disturbing trend that we're not thinking about it from the perspective of what's going to make our lives great, but instead we're putting a different value first, which is the earth and the kind of impact that we're going to have on it.
So let me ask you a question. I mean, how should a mother think about that issue? So in the context of the fact that there are claims concerning catastrophic environmental effects and so on, if that is the context, if those are the kinds of claims are being made and mothers have to make decisions about what to do with respect to having a child or not, what would you advise them? I mean, how would you advise them to think about that issue, think about that choice? What kind of questions would they have to ask themselves to figure out what should I be doing?
Well, you know, I think about it like some of the things we've talked about, how it's what's going to increase your personal happiness. Let me just tell you, take on the issue from another perspective, because when I grew up, I definitely got the environmentalist message in grade school. And I wanted to sort of think about how that played out and what that meant to me as a child. Because after all, if you're telling a parent or you're telling someone you shouldn't have children because they're going to impact the environment, that's a message maybe that children are also going to hear and to think about and to take personally, which is definitely what I did. So when I was in grade school, I was encouraged to enter an environmental speech contest. And what we did was we were supposed to write short persuasive speeches on an environmentalist topic of our choice. And, you know, if you know anything about me, you know that I really like a contest. And so this was sort of no exception, that I was in it to win it. But I was also kind of shy. And so my strategy was to do something, you know, kind of funny. I think that's what people, you know, if you're a little bit shy, you want to do well, maybe you're going to take the funny approach, which is definitely what I did. And so I decided to write my speech on disposable diapers, which is, today I have definitely a different perspective on disposable diapers. But okay, so I know we're on the radio, so you can't see me doing this, but the title of my speech was Disposable Diapers, Time to Change Our Ways. And yeah, when I said change, I would literally stick my hands up into the air and do the scare quotes. And my speech was about, you know, that disposable diapers were one way in which we were ruining the planet. They were piling up in landfills, and they're this terrible thing that we would have to stop using and have to stop, polluting the earth with. And, you know, as much as I would try to be funny and lighthearted about it, it also, I have to say that the listening to the other students do their speeches and in gathering the facts for mine, it was really hard to stay lighthearted about it, because the message that I was getting was that, look, we're ruining the planet just by the fact that we're alive. So if you're using water, so people do speeches about water conservation, you're taking up these precious resources that we should otherwise leave alone. disposable diapers, just another way in which we're kind of ruining the planet and polluting the earth. And I really took that message seriously. Like, what are you going to do about that? You know, if you choose to live and to make and you want to have a and you want to have a life, how are you going to reconcile those things? So I call this the original sin of environmentalism. So just by the very fact that you're alive, and in order to live and do all the things that make our lives great, you have to use resources. And that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing. But, you know, as a kid, I desperately wanted to be on the side of doing what's right and doing the moral thing. And so I reached this point where it was this real conundrum for me. And it kind of came to a head when I had this horrifying thought that, well, look, I'd been a baby once. Okay, so that's not horrifying in itself. But that, you know, did I use disposable diapers? And if so, what business do I have telling other people what they should or shouldn't do in that regard? So I went and asked my mom, you know, I was nervous about it. Mom, when I was a baby, did you use disposable diapers? And she told me that, you know, when we, unfortunately, it was a luxury that we couldn't afford. So, and then she went on to describe in detail about how, well, you know, we had the cloth kind and that took, you know, an enormous amount of time and it was not very sanitary and you had to, you know, wash them out and that took resources as well. And it just, when it comes down to it, there's nothing, whether green, you know, the green or environmentalist ideology, there's nothing that you can do to win. So you want to use disposable diapers. Okay, that uses resources. If you use the cloth variety, that's bad too. And I couldn't wrap my head around what was going on and how to navigate through that space. And, you know, I've read recently, there's an op-ed that you can find on our website, No Footprint, No Life, by Keith Blockage. And he talks about diapers specifically. And I really wish that when I was a kid that someone had been, you know, given me this point of view, a different way of thinking about what it means to be a human and what it means to be a good person. And in this op-ed, he says something about environmentalist ideology that I think is really illuminating. He says, what do environmentalists say about diapers specifically? He says, quote, from the Earth's point of view, it's not all that important which kind of diapers you use. The important decision was having the baby. So he's making the point that, look, in order to survive, in order to, you know, live a good life, you part of doing that is using resources. And that's a good thing. That's a moral thing. Those are precisely the things that make our lives great. And from my perspective now, man, I love disposable diapers. They are awesome. I mean, it's sanitary. They have technology embedded where you can, you can tell if the diaper is wet or dry just by looking. There's this amazing gel in there that, you know, wicks up the moisture. The baby doesn't get wet.
Little GPS chip.
That's probably in there too. And, you know, I just, as a kid, you know, I didn't really have the tools to deal with what the environmentalist messages that I was receiving. And so it's part of the reason why I'm so passionate about, you know, talking about environmentalism, really offering people a different point of view. So it looks like we have on our On the Road celebrity guest hotline. looks like Don Watkins is calling. And so, see, Don, are you there?
I am, although now everybody's going to be disappointed.
I don't think so. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show. So would you like to weigh in? Do you think having children is a selfish decision or a sacrifice?
Well, it depends on the parents. I mean, it really depends on your context. I think most people have babies without thinking about it. And in that context, there's no issue of is it a sacrifice or not, because you're not actually rationally pursuing any values. But if you're thoughtful, having kids can be an amazing value. I mean, I have two myself. I have one, a daughter about to turn 3 and a son about to turn 1. And they've added such an enormous amount to my life. And the people who try to make that choice be a source of guilt rather than a source of joy, I mean, I regard that as that by itself should be enough to make you, let's put it nicely, at least enormously suspicious of the ideology that is being put forward.
So you're on the road, right? What are you doing on the road?
Well, let's see. It's been about a week and a half since my book with Yaron Brook, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, came out. And so both of us have been traveling around the country. Yaron is actually, I think, international right now. And just talking to, you know, a bunch of different people about the book. I'm actually in Colorado right now about to talk to a really cool program called Leadership Program of the Rockies, which trains people who are going to go into Colorado politics, who are involved in it in one way or another. And let's see, tomorrow is down to Texas to speak to the San Antonio Tea Party. And then I will finally be returning home so that I can spend a week getting ready for the next round of talks.
All right. So tell me a little bit more about your book. 'Cause this issue of income inequality, I think it's an important one that a lot of people are hearing about. So, for example, Bernie Sanders, on his website, he says, the issue of wealth and income inequality is the great moral issue of our time. But you have a different message. What is your message?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good topic to bring up here because you've been talking about environmentalism. And basically, there's kind of two major arguments that have animated people, you can put as broadly on the left lately, that all our problems can be explained in one way or another by environmentalism or specifically climate change or by economic inequality. And often those two are grouped together, but, you know, one makes the other worse and so on. And the whole debate about economic inequality is really embedded in a bigger debate about the state of the American dream. And I think a lot of people believe, and certainly we've been told by our leaders, that the American dream is in decline. And the major voices trying to explain that and give us a solution to it are the critics of economic inequality, whether it be Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders, or whether it be people like Paul Krugman or the economist Joseph Stiglitz. There's just a bunch of voices that have really tried to make this the central issue. And at the core of their explanation for what's gone wrong is that the rich are getting richer, they're rigging the system, and the rest of us are stagnating. And then their solutions always have at their center, we have to bring down the rich. We have to undermine them in some way. And so Thomas Piketty, who's one of the major economists behind this crusade, he suggests that we should have 80% marginal top income tax rates, a 10% wealth tax, which means, you know, not your income, but all the things you own, the government's going to tax you up to 10% year after year after year after year. Campaign finance restrictions to stop rich people from having political influence. And the way that I think about it is, to put it simply, is this, that you can't revive the American dream by vilifying and penalizing those who epitomize the American dream. Mm-hmm. That the American dream is really about unlimited opportunity. And to achieve unlimited opportunity, you have to make a nation that is conducive to, that nurtures the creation of wealth, that really celebrates productive achievement. And so at the broadest terms, then, what I think really needs to be done to revive the American dream is make America safe for producers. And that means we need to learn to actually liberate productive achievement and celebrate productive achievement.
So talking about celebrating productive achievement, I want to ask you a little bit more about inequality and industrialization. So in your book on page 25 and 26, you talk a little bit about industrialization. So I think a lot of people believe that, okay, so if there is wealth or income inequality, that's going to lead to people who are poor being a lot worse off. And you make actually the opposite argument. You're talking about America in the late 1800s and early 1900s, when there was no things like the minimum wage and things that what you would think of today as trying to mitigate or stop income inequality. But there was also an incredible lift in the standard of living for everyone. So you name some inventions like running water, sanitation, pasteurization, advanced medicine, hot showers. So what actually happened when there was no control over income inequality?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really important question because we usually equate inequality with the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer. But inequality just refers to a gap. It refers to some people make more than others. But that gap can grow even if everybody is getting better off. And that is actually the story of capitalism, and in particular if we're talking about the era of industrialization. So industrialization really just means that we created a bunch of machines powered by fossil fuels, by the way, that did our work for us and therefore made us much more productive so that we could have just this incredible array of products and goods and resources that lifted our standard of living. And so this was really the process by which we became, all of us by historic standards, became incredibly rich. And so what you saw was two things. One was this like slew of new inventions, right? New inventions pioneered by all kinds of people. But what you also saw was a scale of production that had never been equaled. That is, it's not just that we invented steel, it's that we supplied a nation with steel. It's not just that somebody invented an automobile, it's that Henry Ford supplied a nation with cars. And how did they do this? Well, the industrialists, the people who got the richest, they basically provided their workers with these enormous expensive machines that made a worker now, instead of being able to produce a few shoes a day, being able to produce, let's say, hundreds of shoes a day. And what happened as a result is workers became more productive, and so they got paid more. They saw their wages increase, and they had more than ever to buy with those wages because of all the new inventions, and they could afford more of the stuff because the price kept going down because the cost of production was getting lowered because of these amazing machines. So you saw this just benevolent circle of everybody getting better off. And did people like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller get better off than everybody? Yeah, by miles. But guess what? The reason everybody else was getting better off was because these guys were pioneering progress. So it just illustrates why economic inequality is not something to be afraid of in a free society. What you have to be afraid of is when people are able to stop others from producing and take what they produce. And sometimes that can increase inequality, but it's not the inequality we care about. It's the theft, the exploitation.
So I talk a little bit about modern inventors or modern producers, because I think people just automatically, when they hear about a CEO making many, many more times the amount of wage that one of his workers is making, that they think that there's something, that there's some sort of exploiting going on of workers. So what do you think about that?
I mean, it's really interesting that we're taught to have very strong opinions about how much CEOs get paid, but how many people can answer the question, what does a CEO do? Not very many. Not very many people can tell you. And yet we should know it, at least at a pretty kind of common sense level. They make a huge difference. I mean, you can just think of Apple with and without Steve Jobs. Now, not every CEO makes that big a difference, but every CEO is responsible for all of the big picture decisions that govern the direction of a company. And how much should they get paid for that? Well, that's nobody's business but the owners. The CEO pay doesn't come out of workers' pockets. It comes out of the owners' pockets. And owners have judged CEOs on the whole as worth what they get paid. Now, let's put this in perspective, because we often hear of like the most enormous pay packages. But for the S&P 500, these are the 500 biggest companies by revenue, from $2 billion to $200 billion a year. Do you know what the average CEO makes each year?
No.
Well, you would probably guess, oh, man, it must be, you know, $100 million. It's just over $10.5 million. Now, that's a lot of money. But when your decisions are affecting the fate of a, let's say, $100 billion company, even a 1% change, even if your decisions make a 1% difference in the upside or the downside, you are generating or losing way more wealth than anything approaching $10.5 million. And so I think just on the face of it, the idea that there's something suspicious about the people running these companies making significant amounts of money is bizarre. I mean, just think about, you know, a basketball player like LeBron James. His pay last year was something over $20 million a year. But we're not as upset about that. In fact, most people think that's a great thing because they could see the value he creates. But we don't see the value CEOs create because we have an anti-business prejudice that has made it so that we've never been taught the crucial productive role of top managers and top entrepreneurs.
So you have people, you know, protesting, like maybe fast food workers who want a higher wage, and they're upset about the income disparity between what they're earning and what maybe their managers or the CEO of the fast food company is earning. How should they view the people on top of their company?
So I don't think that it's anybody's. I don't think that you should be thinking about your pay in terms of what your boss or anybody else makes. As a general rule in life, other people's pay is none of your business. Other people's net worth is none of your business because it's not taken from you. It's something that they earn in their own merits. Your whole focus should be, am I in a job that I like, and am I being paid fairly for it? And what that really means is, if I think that my work is worth more, then I can either ask my company for more or I can go find somebody else willing to pay me more. But there's no meaning to the idea of, yeah, my work is really worth more, but nobody's going to pay me that much. No, what you deserve, I think, what justice requires is that you receive the rewards based on the economic value you create as judged by the people you voluntarily interact with. So think about, for instance, how Stephen King became rich. It wasn't that he wrote a book and handed it over to the government and they said, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Here's a grant for, you know, $10 million. He's Stephen King, so probably hundreds of millions of dollars, right? It's mm-hmm. that each individual voluntarily bought his book for $10 or $20. And the result was that because millions of people made those decisions, he became a millionaire. Now, why did they make those decisions? They valued the book. They thought, yeah, this book is worth more than $20 for me, so I'm going to buy it. So you saw inequality grow as Stephen King became super rich, but everybody was better off as a result. Well, the same principle applies to how you should think about your work. What you want to do is maximize your success through creating enough value that people voluntarily are going to pay you for your services. Now, one caveat to this, I don't think that like money is everything, right? I think that your fundamental goal in work should be that you're self-supporting, but that you have work that you really enjoy. But if we're just looking at it from the money perspective, it's if you're not happy with what you make, find somebody willing to pay you more or go develop the skills to get paid more. But I'll tell you this, the people complaining, I want a $15 an hour wage enforced by government, I would be willing to wager that 99.9% of them are not the people who deserve $15, because the people who actually deserve that kind of money are the ones who don't need it forced out of the pockets of their managers and who don't expect something for nothing. They expect to work for it, prove themselves, and earn it through their own achievements.
So what can listeners do to support the launch of your book?
Well, the first thing they should do is make sure that they want to support it. So, I mean, the book is available, you know, more or less anywhere. Certainly Amazon.com is an easy way to get it. But if they go to equalsunfair.com, they can read the first chapter for free. And if they do like it, though, and I think, I mean, let me just say, since nobody else is here to praise the book, unless you want to do it, we really, I think, so first of all, the left has been putting out 15 books a year saying that inequality is a moral scourge. Nobody, there have been basically zero, or you can say kind of like 1.5 books that have kind of taken issue with that. This is really the first book to address the whole case against the case against inequality. And we really try to lay out in a super clear, accessible way the arguments made by people like Bernie Sanders, what's wrong with them, and then to challenge their moral ideal of economic equality and say that, no, if we're actually concerned with human life, we're actually concerned with individuals being able to achieve happiness, then what we need to be concerned with is maximizing opportunity. And the way that you do that is not the injustice of penalizing producers for how productive they are, but is actually justice for producers, protecting all of our freedom to go out there, make a living, and keep what we earn. And so we try to just lay it out step by step and in a way that people can actually use, so that if they agree with us, they can go out there and they can put the inequality critics on the defensive. And so if that's something that somebody's interested in, like, the number one thing that they can do is just buy as many copies of the book as they can afford and get it into the hands of anybody that they think is open to a new perspective. And then aside from that, certainly reviews on Amazon. It's really important to buy it at bookstores too. And if your bookstore doesn't have it, one of the best things that you could do is say, hey, you guys don't have this book that's, you know, been selling a lot and that I definitely want. Can you guys get this into stock? All that stuff goes a long way to helping get this book on everybody's radar screen. And I think this is critical, because I think anybody who's a champion of free markets needs there to be an opposition to the number one intellectual challenge against free markets today, which is the inequality crusade.
Yeah, I'll second that. So I've read the book. I found it to be really illuminating on this issue. Like you said, it's something that everybody is talking about. It colors certainly what political candidates are saying and the debate that people are having. Inequality comes up again and again and again. And this book is an answer to you know, the conventional view and what people are saying that we should do about it. So it's a really important book in terms of just understanding the debate and what's happening, and also in terms of, you know, intellectual ammunition. And it shows a different way of thinking about the issue that I think people will find illuminating. So definitely want to go out and get the book.
Cool. Hey, Don, let me ask, this is Aaron. I'm going to ask you a question. So if I'm not an opinion maker in the world, I'm not an economist, I haven't studied finance or so on, what interest of this would have, of the book have to a kind of a wider audience, as opposed to people who are talking about, thinking about, writing about the inequality debate? Does this matter to the guy on the street?
I'm so glad you asked that, because this is actually an aspect I don't get to talk about enough, because people are primarily interested in the political aspect. But think about it this way. We all got to work, right? Like, work is central to our lives. And one of the worst things that's happened is, and I think this is driven by critics of capitalism, but it's not primarily a political issue, is we've never been taught how to value productive work, what it means to make work a key cornerstone, that's kind of redundant, a cornerstone of your pursuit of happiness. And so a lot of what our book is what does success mean? How do you actually achieve a career for yourself that is fulfilling and meaningful? What role does money play in that? Is money everything? Is money nothing? And how should we think about other people's success? Should that be a source of resentment? Should that be a source of inspiration? And so let me just give you kind of one concrete example of something that I think is really relevant. So in their whole pursuit of leveling down, of redistributing wealth from top producers, the inequality critics know that if they just came out and said, we're going to take what you earn and give it to other people, that's not really going to, let's say, be a very inspiring agenda. At least people would be suspicious of that and think, that doesn't sound very fair. So what they try to do is say nobody really earns their money, because success is really a matter of luck. It depends on having the right parents, about being born with money, about being born intelligent. It's all a matter of luck. Now, there's many things wrong with that argument, but just think in terms of its consequences to a young person who, let's say, doesn't have all those things, who's starting out without a great education or with parents who aren't rich. What would happen if he took those ideas seriously? If you were told, hey, buddy, don't worry, where you end up is just a matter of luck. Are you going to try really hard to make something in your life, or are you just going to go throw up your hands and say, I guess it's just a roll of the dice? That is, this luck argument that we hear all the time has real consequences in a person's life if it leads him to basically say, think of yourself as a victim, kid, because you can't actually make yourself successful through your own actions. So that's just one of many ways in which the ideas of this political debate have real consequences to all of our lives, whether or not we're that interested in politics.
Okay, well, thanks for that.
Yeah, Don, thanks for joining us on the program.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
All right, bye-bye. All right, we're going to take another quick commercial break.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, who cares? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn, and the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, we're back. So we're just about out of time, so I want to end the show like Yaron ends the show, on a positive note. So even though Earth Day is coming up on April 22nd, and on Earth Day, you know, what typically happens is that we're asked to take one day out of our lives to put the Earth first, as the Green Movement would put it. So we're asked to make sacrifices, big and small, for the planet. And if you go to the Earth Day website, you can sign up. You can sign up to have your act of green counted. And they have something like a billion of these little things that people have sacrificed for the planet. So whether it's I bike to work today, or I didn't wash my clothes because that takes up, you know, resources. You can look through this catalog of these, you know, billion acts of green, these little sacrifices that people are making for the earth. And so I think, you know, on Earth Day, instead of having a, you know, let's sacrifice for the Earth Day and let's think about how terrible people are because they're polluting the planet and using resources. Instead, we should have a, you know, let's have a How Awesome Are People Day. And we can really celebrate instead the value that we bring to our lives through industrialization, through all of these things that people scoff at as wasteful luxuries. And so in that vein, I wanted to play for you a little clip from an interview that I did a couple of years ago. I interviewed Magdalena Sajeda. She's one of the directors of a film called Frack Nation. That film's been out for a while. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it. I think it's a good film. It talks about what fracking is and how it works and how it's contributing to explosion, for lack of a better term, of more and more energy production, cheap, and how people are able to get now natural gas cheaply and more safely and efficiently than ever before. So she's one of the directors of that film. And in the interview, I ask her about, you know, things like what is fracking? Why did you make the film? But one thing that she said always stuck with me, which is when I asked her why the issue of energy production was important to her and why she had decided to help make this film, that definitely gives a different view of, what human beings should or shouldn't be doing in terms of, you know, taking natural gas or energy from the ground and using it for our benefit. Her answer was surprisingly personal. So I want to play that answer for you now.
Now, myself, you know, I was born and raised in Poland. I only left when I was 21. And so I have my own experiences. And yes, I think those experiences actually determined of how I view those issues. And that's because, you see, I grew up with very expensive and intermittent energy. So in Poland, like in most of Eastern Europe and a lot of Western Europe, we, first of all, we have very cold winters, but we also get our gas from foreign sources, and most of our gas comes from Russia, from a state-run company, practically Gazprom, and the gas for us is extremely expensive, and it has a real, real impact on people's lives. It's something that you actually experience every day, from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep. And so, you know, I could tell you of my childhood stories, but you know, we had the lights going out, and you know, it was impossible to do homework on next day, and you know, my parents would have to write like a note for the teacher saying, you know, well, we had no light in the house for, you know, 5 hours in the evening, and Magda was unable to write an essay because of that. We had situations where, you know, an energy bill arriving on our house, a gas bill, was a major dramatic event. I mean, this is something that nobody looked forward to. My parents would open, look at the numbers, and they would be, my God, how are we going to pay this, first of all? And then they would get out, you know, a box with the rainy day money, you know, and take it from there. And then there would be a major discussion of how can we make the gas bill lower for the next month, and that would involve rationing, you know, in our own house. So, for example, not everyone was able to take a warm shower. Let me just leave it at that. And Poland is now the third world country. It's a developed country. You know, there was nothing missing in my house, but the fact that, you know, that the energy was so expensive, you know, affected even a family like ours, which was, you know, which wasn't, we weren't going hungry, you know, but it was something that that was really frustrating for me when I was growing up, and I knew even back then that there was something wrong with it, that life doesn't supposed to look like this. And that's why, you know, I have that's why possibly I have a very different view of those issues than many people here in Los Angeles of my age.
So that's Magdalena Sajeda talking about why growing up in Poland, that it was hard, that there wasn't enough cheap, reliable, and plentiful energy to have a hot shower. And on Earth Day, I want to, you know, celebrate, like I said, how awesome it is to be a human being. And part of that are things that we might, you know, take for granted, like having a hot shower every day. So let me ask you this, Aaron. What is the value of a hot shower to you?
Wow. Well, I don't know what I'd say to that. I certainly have one every morning. It's the way I start my day. I don't want to feel like I'm camping, you know, where you kind of just wake up tired and pasty, and it's like, you know, it helps me get my day started, and it's frankly something I enjoy. The pure luxury of the fact. I mean, and the fact that it's not a luxury for us here in the U.S. That isn't a luxury. It's something you wind up taking for granted. But given a lot of the, you know, the calls for privation and so on, I think we should think about what it would mean if that were a luxury, you know, something that you could only have, say, once a week or whichever. And think about a number of the kind of things that we take for granted, everything from toasters to washer and dryers and things like that. If you really do regard those, like in the situation that that Magdalena was going through in Poland, if you really consider those things as luxuries, it's good to put that into perspective as to, you know, when you think about what kind of, you know, privations people are advocating for.
Yeah, and I think it's important that, you know, in 1970, just a few months, I think, after the first Earth Day, Ayn Rand gave a talk titled The Anti-Industrial Revolution. And in it, she talks about the goals of what was then the ecology movement. It's now morphed into the environmentalist movement. And that she said, if you really took them seriously, people would, you know, they would scream out in protest. And yet people don't scream out in protest. So when on Earth Day, you're told bike to work, doesn't matter how far the distance, don't eat meat today because that's something you shouldn't be doing. Don't, you know, forego a hot shower. You know, I think there is a tendency, one of the reasons why people don't stand up and protest and say, no, these are things that make our lives better. They make our lives longer, safer, and happier. And it's part of what it means to be a human being is to continually make our lives, more productive and happier. And a hot shower is definitely part of that. But people don't scream out in protest when we're told that these are something that we should scoff at as sort of wasteful luxuries. And like you said, Magdalena's growing up in Poland, it was, you know, she said energy, the fact that it was so expensive and hard to get was part of their, unfortunately, part of the considerations of their daily lives, and that we don't have to worry about that. But one of the things that can happen is that you might take those things for granted. So I think it's important on Earth Day to celebrate those things and to not take them for granted, because if you don't stand up for the values of industrialization and the things that environmentalists are telling us that are not important, that we should give up, and there's always more to give up, that we eventually will be forced to give those up. We're not going to be asked. Eventually we'll be told that we don't get to have those things. And so, yeah, think about just the history of the hot shower. So today it's routine, right? Most people don't even go for a whole week but they don't go for a day without taking a hot shower. But, you know, around 1900 in America, it was a bit of a luxury. And by the 1920s, people, it was becoming more and more commonplace that every home, new house that was being built had a shower. And in fact, in 1915, the Sears Roebuck catalog. That was the first time that they sold a shower, which is pretty cool. And in 1965, about 85% of houses had both a shower and a tub, which is really pretty great. That this thing that we think of as, you know, maybe we take for granted was, you know, becoming the norm in America. And I want to read you a little quote from David Lingefelter. He's the president of Moen. Moen makes shower fixtures, if you don't know. It's just kind of cool how he describes. So his, what they do at Moen is they're trying to always invent more and more better ways to for people to enjoy taking a shower. And he says this, quote, "We spent a lot of time figuring out how to make water create the sensation of a massage when designing shower fixtures. Our Revolution showerhead actually spins each drop of water that it puts out and then twirls the whole shower stream so that users feel enveloped in water. Making the water droplets seem larger makes them feel warmer, and the increased speed and movement of each drop gives the sensation of higher flow and higher pressure," unquote. So,
where's my credit card?
Yeah, I know, right? I think it's really cool that there are people thinking you know, about how to make just the simple act of taking a shower better all the time. And that's something, you know, it's a small thing, but I think it's something that we should celebrate. So with that, I will end the show. I want to talk just a little bit about some of the upcoming events that we have at the Ayn Rand Institute. If you go to the Ayn Rand Institute webpage at ari.aynrand.org, you can click on the events tab and get a full list of everything that's coming up. We always have new events added to the list, and there's a lot of activity this month in April. So there's events in San Antonio, Texas, a couple in Brazil, and Israel, and towards the end of the month, so on April 19th, Don Watkins is going to be doing a talk and a signing of Equal is Unfair. So if you're if you listened in and were piqued what Don had to say about his new book, co-authored with Yaron Brook, piqued your interest, you can come to Irvine, California, and listen to what he has to say about the book and get your book signed. And on April 20th, he'll be in Tucson, Arizona, giving a talk about Equal is Unfair as well. So definitely want to go to the website and check out the events in your area. All right, well, Aaron, thank you very much for being here today and for talking about selfishness and babies and Earth Day. Oh, my.
Thanks, Amanda. It was great to be here.
All right. We'll see you next time.